ABC is presenting from London a series of pre-coronation programs, The Story of the Coronation, compiled and broadcast by Ted Malone and Blevins Davis. Tonight, our reporters interview the unpublicized personalities of the coronation, guardsmen, coachmen, musicians, and others, all of whom have many interesting stories to tell. For example, one of the royal seamstresses will tell you that the kind of stitches taken in the royal robe is a closely guarded secret. For colorful facts, listen tonight for The Story of the Coronation. And be with us on ABC on Tuesday morning for on-the-spot coverage of the coronation itself, and on Tuesday evening for coronation highlights. In cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation, the Public Affairs Department of the American Broadcasting Company presents the third in a series of six transcribed lectures entitled Living in an Atomic Age by the distinguished English philosopher, mathematician, sociologist, and author Bertrand Russell. The subject of the third lecture is The Modern Mastery of Nature. Lord Russell.
It is the nature of man to be in conflict with something. Some men are victorious, others are defeated. Those who are defeated, as a rule, leave few or no descendants. It follows that the psychology which is transmitted tends to be that of victors, and that where there is a 50-50 chance of victory, optimism will cause the chance to be overestimated. From the point of view of the survivors, this is fortunate. The point of view of the vanquished is forgotten. The contests in which men are engaged are of three kinds. They are conflicts of, first, men with nature, second, men with other men, and third. These conflicts are very different in their character, and with the history of man, their relative importance is continually changing. Of these three kinds of contest, the contest with physical nature is, in a sense, the most fundamental, since victory in this contest is essential to survival. Men who perish in a glacial epoch, or when hitherto fertile regions dry up, or when earthquakes engulf whole valleys, have lost their contest with physical nature. So have all those who die in famines and pestilences. Every victory over physical nature makes possible an increase in the numbers of the human species, and has usually been used mainly to this end. But in proportion as man masters his environment, his relations to his fellow men assume increasing importance, partly because the technique of mastery over nature involves social groups more coherent than those of the most primitive men, and partly because in proportion as the winning of daily bread becomes easier, a greater amount of energy can be set aside for the killing of enemies. There comes, however, a moment in human evolution when, owing to the growth of technique, men can become richer through agreement with previous competitors than through extermination of enemies. When this stage is reached, what may be called the demands of technique require a cessation or at least mitigation of the conflicts of man with man. When this stage is reached, it is in fact the stage which mankind has reached at the present moment, the conflicts that most need to be resolved are the conflicts of man with himself. The long ages of the other two kinds of conflict have molded human nature to a pattern formerly appropriate, but now technically obsolete. The ages of external warfare reflected themselves in an internal war in the soul. In this internal war in the soul, one part labeled the other sin and determined to vanquish it. But the victory was never so complete as in external conflicts. And after every defeat, sin would again rear its ugly head. This unending warfare within, which was originally a reflection of the warfare without, now became, on the contrary, a source of the warfare without. Sin is only part of my nature, but it is the whole nature of my enemies. So at least the old-fashioned moralist believes. And therefore the soul which is not at peace with itself cannot be at peace with the world. And external wars have to continue in order to hide from individual men that the real war is within. For these reasons, the war of man with himself, is that which, at the end of human evolution, assumes supreme importance. Each kind of war should end in harmony. The conflict of man with physical nature is turned into a harmony in proportion as man learns the secrets of nature and thereby becomes able to cooperate with her. The conflict of man with man serves a purpose so long as there is no possibility of adequate food supply for all. But when the conquest of nature has secured the possibility of adequate food supply for all, and when the growth of technique has made large-scale cooperation profitable, the conflict of man with man becomes an anachronism and should end in a political and economic unification such as is sought by the advocates of world government. By this means, an external harmony of man with man can be established, but it will not be a genuine harmony until men have achieved a genuine harmony within themselves and have ceased to regard a part of themselves as an enemy to be vanquished. This, in a nutshell, is the history of man, past, present, and, I hope, future. Man has had an existence which is long in relation to historical time, but short in relation to geological epochs. Our first human ancestors were a very rare species. They lived under precarious conditions, exposed to the rigors of the weather, to the hostility of wild beasts, and to all the dangers of famine that could be caused by drought. The chief worry was as to food supply. It is estimated that each individual at that time required at least 2 square miles for his subsistence, and even with 2 square miles at his disposal, he would often be hungry and not infrequently die from lack of nourishment. Gradually, however, man emerged from these precarious conditions by various stages. Weapons, fire, language, domestication of animals, and finally agriculture. These successive inventions and discoveries made possible the existence of civilized communities. They supplied the whole fundamental apparatus upon which civilized man subsisted for a very long time. From about 3000 BC until less than 200 years ago, there was no technical advance comparable to these. During this long period, man had time to become accustomed to his technique and to develop the beliefs and political organizations appropriate to it. Towards the end of the 18th century, man entered upon a new phase, involving a change as fundamental as that involved in the adoption of agriculture. I mean, of course, machine production and the application of science to industry. Physical science, one may say, has existed as a powerful element in culture for about 350 years. Machine production has existed for about half that time. During the period since its invention, it has shown itself to be a revolutionary force of quite amazing intensity. As yet, this has been almost solely operative in man's relation to nature. But by revolutionizing man's relation to nature, it has destroyed the old equilibrium that existed in man's relation to other men and to himself. The revolutions that it demands in these two provinces are still to seek, and it is the fact that they are still to seek which is the main cause of the present troubles of the world. The specially human activities which distinguish man from other animals all depend upon the lessening of his bondage to physical nature. So long as he had to spend all his time in food gathering, he could not devote much of his energy to war or politics or theology or science. These things are offshoots of the productivity of labor. They depend upon the excess of one man's production over one man's consumption of food. The greater this excess becomes, the more possible it becomes for a man to devote himself to politics and war and culture and such luxuries. Pharaoh and Nebuchadnezzar, Socrates and Plato, Buddha and Mohammed, Leonardo and Bach, all were only possible because the food producers could produce more than they could eat. But when one considers such a community as the United States in the present day, one finds a new phenomenon, namely that the great majority of the population enjoy very many things over and above the bare necessaries of life, and yet, in spite of this, very large parts of the population are not engaged in production, whether agricultural or industrial. There are all the young people who are still being educated after they have become able-bodied. There are the armed forces. There are the journalists and all the people concerned in the production of reading matter. There are teachers, clergy, politicians, and functionaries. All these people, from the point of view of primitive men, are luxuries. But a modern community would be impossible without at least some of them. The liberation from bondage to nature has left men in theory free to choose their own ends to a degree that was never possible at any earlier time. I say in theory, because impulses incorporated into human nature by long ages of training and natural selection remain to determine human action independently of present physical needs. What a nation can spare from increasing its own numbers, it devotes only in part to its own welfare. To a very great extent, it devotes its energies to killing other people, or preparing to kill them, or paying those who have helped to kill them in the past. Our new mastery over nature brings new responsibilities and new duties. If men prove incapable of this adaptation, the whole movement of science and scientific technique will have proved a misfortune, and perhaps will have taken man along a blind alley. While we were slaves to nature, we could allow ourselves a slave mentality and leave to nature decisions which must now be ours. This is difficult, since great parts of traditional religion and morality were inspired by man's bondage to nature, and the ways of thought and feeling that we acquire from our culture and from our early upbringing are hard to overcome, even when circumstances imperatively demand a different outlook. I am not pretending that man is omnipotent. On the contrary, I shall be concerned in subsequent broadcasts with the limits of human power. But I am concerned to say that these limits are much less narrow for modern scientific men than they were for our ancestors, and that no precise boundary can be set beyond which the limits cannot be made to recede. Innumerable facts of nature, which once were inexorable data, are now opportunities. Deserts are a challenge. Australian rivers can be made to flow from east to west instead of from west to east. Before long, it will be possible to demolish inconvenient parts of mountain ranges, and I dare say that by means of radioactivity, the polar ice will be melted. It will not be long before it becomes possible to travel to the moon. We already know how to combat many kinds of pestilence, and we may hope to eliminate other kinds before long. Our nomad ancestors, while they watched their flocks by night, observed the stars in their inexorable courses, and believed themselves subject to the influences of celestial bodies. Wind and storm, drought and heat, comets and meteors and plagues filled their lives with awe, and they hoped to escape by means of humility. Modern man does not combat plagues by humility. He has found that they are to be combated by scientific knowledge. Scientific knowledge, in fact, gives the means, where there are means, of combating any extra human enemy. But it does not give the means of combating the human enemy without, or the part of the individual soul which leads it towards death rather than towards life. The problems of man's contest with nature, insofar as they are soluble, can be solved by physical science. But they are not the only problems with which man is faced. For his other problems, other methods are necessary.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the third in a series of six lectures by Bertrand Russell entitled Living in an Atomic Age. This has been a transcribed feature of the Public Affairs Department of ABC in cooperation with the British Broadcasting Corporation, and the program came to you from New York. This is ABC Radio Network.